Howdy, listener, and thanks for tuning into our podcast, The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. My name is Izzy.
And my name is David. Each week, one of us will pick a movie that the other has not seen. We will deep dive into our individual takes and historical background of the movie.
Please subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Instagram at TML A Journey Through Cinema and Twitter at TML A Journey. Hello, everyone! Today we are talking about The Apartment, a movie directed by Billy Wilder from a screenplay also by Wilder and I.A.L. Diamond, starring Jack Lemmon, Shirley MacLaine, and Fred McMurray, chosen by my dad. So, Dad, why did you choose this movie?
I chose this movie for a couple of reasons. Billy Wilder is one of my favorite directors. His output from 1950 to 1960 is as good as any stretch compared to any other director. He is often most remembered for his screenwriting over his directing, but I think that is a skill that he should be recognized for. So I wanted to go back and watch a movie that I feel that I remember him really flaunting or exercising that directing skill. And then I wanted to revisit a film that I felt would be just as comfortable in today's world of hybrid movies, you know, comedy dramas, comedy action, action adventure, and in this case, a comedy drama romance. He did a really good job of blending genres, so I wanted to go back and examine it and see, did I remember this film as good as it is?
So what is this movie about?
I really recommend, if you have not seen The Apartment, to stop this podcast right now, go and watch The Apartment, and then come back to this spot and watch and listen to us talk about it. But if you don't have time to do that, here is a brief rundown of what the movie is about. Jack Lemmon plays C.C. Baxter, an up-and-coming insurance executive who lends his Upper West Side apartment to his bosses to use for extramarital affairs. In exchange for the use of his apartment, his senior manager, Mr. Sheldrake, played by Fred McMurray, promotes Baxter. Disappointed when he learns that Mr. Sheldrake's mistress is Fran Kubelik, played by Shirley MacLaine, who he is also interested in, Baxter must decide between the woman he loves and the advancement of his career. That is The Apartment in a nutshell. So Izzy, this is our first black and white film on the list, and currently the oldest, being made in 1960. What was your first takeaway when you watched this film?
I thought it was a really good movie. It was beautiful to look at. I've grown up with black and white films, so it's not as jarring to me to watch a black and white film. But I do have to say, out of all of them, if I remember correctly, this is like the one that was like the most clear. You know, black and white is like known to be kind of like, I don't want to say grainy, but it's...
Well, a lot of that grittiness comes from transfer after transfer off the negative. When you get a really nice transfer, like the version that we saw, you get that really nice, crisp, black and white look. It is really pretty to look at.
Also, I thought it was very interesting, because this movie is made in 1960, you know, that's like the time where like all of the trends that are happening now started. It's a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy of a movie. And so being a huge rom-com fan now, which you build this to me as like a wacky rom-com, I thought when I was first watching this that it was going to happen one of two ways. The first way I thought it was going to go is that when we are introduced to the elevator operator played by Shirley MacLaine, it's mentioned by one of C.C. Baxter's bosses that he would like to date her. And of course, that scene riding up to the elevator, we are given an amazing opportunity to see C.C. Baxter and Fran Kubelik's chemistry together. So my first thought was that we were going to get the traditional, he wants to win this girl's affections, she doesn't want to date him, she dates somebody else, and then he falls in love with another woman that we would ultimately meet in Act 2. Or something bad was going to happen to her and that he was going to be there to be her knight in shining armor, and then she's going to realize that she deserves to be with him all along, which to a point kind of happened, but not in the stereotypical way. So, Dad, the film doesn't seem to be a standard paint-by-numbers rom-com, like I just said. So what inspired Billy Wilder to make it?
I realized after I selected this film, I told you, yeah, it's kind of a romantic comedy. I forgot to tell you about the dramatic elements of this film. So I apologize for that. After the success of Some Like It Hot in 1959, Wilder was looking for a new idea to work on with his writing partner, I.A.L. Diamond. Some Like It Hot was nominated for 5 Academy Awards, including Best Director. It had didn't win any awards, but it was nominated, and it was a huge hit.
Which is what I thought when you told me about this movie. I thought it was going to be more akin to Some Like It Hot, this wacky screwball comedy.
Yes, and I think a lot of people thought that was the direction he was going to go, because usually in Billy Wilder's past, he would make a few movies along the same lines. So he decided he wanted to make this movie because he had this idea a long time ago, and he thought this was the time to make it. There are three things that really inspired Billy Wilder and I.L. Diamond. Number one, in 1945, Billy Wilder watched Brief Encounter by David Lean, and he was interested in the character that lent his apartment to the two romantic leads that were married and were having an affair. He wanted to know what type of character would lend his apartment for married people to have an affair. He also knew that that story wasn't going to go anywhere in 1945 because audiences weren't ready for that. So he kind of put it in the back burner, saved it for later. So the second thing that happened in 1951 was that movie producer Walter Wanger shot and wounded Jennings Lang, who happened to be Wanger's wife's agent. His wife was Joan Bennett, who was an actress. And he suspected that they were having an affair. Joan Bennett denied it, but what the town discovered was that he was using one of his underlings' apartments so he could meet up with his client, Joan Bennett, so to have the affair. So that was another part of the idea, was here was this underling at the talent agency that Jennings Lang was using his apartment to have an affair. And then the third thing that happened, what actually happened to I.A.L. Diamond, one of his friends broke up with a woman he was dating and left the apartment. And when he returned, the young woman had committed suicide and was laying on his bed. I.A.L. Diamond never forgot about this, and he used it as inspiration in the screenplay when Sheldrake gives Fran $100 instead of a Christmas gift, which implies to Shirley MacLaine's character Fran that what he really thinks about their relationship. And then when he leaves the apartment, she, at that point, makes the decision to attempt suicide. So those three things in their lives were inspiration for the screenplay for The Apartment.
We see Jack Lemmon in a supporting role in Some Like It Hot, but in this role, he is a main character.
Yeah, so Wilder really liked working with Jack Lemmon and on Some Like It Hot. He had seen him in other movies like Mr. Roberts, and thought he was a very good actor and thought he was hilarious, as well as being a thinking actor. Like he was very good at working his characters through. So when he came to set, he was ready. And so when he wrote the lead for The Apartment, that is who he wanted. He didn't want like a traditional movie lead, super handsome and you knew he was going to get the girl and all that. He wanted somebody that was kind of that everyman.
We also see the return of Fred McMurray, where we see him in Double Indemnity.
Double Indemnity.
I know, but I said it wrong.
It's okay. So Double Indemnity, yeah. So there's something that's very unique about Billy Wilder's relationship with Fred McMurray, because Fred McMurray made a lot of Disney movies as like the absent-minded professor, and then he made My Three Sons, where he's the greatest dad in the world. And yet he had this really clean persona. There are two movies that he made with Billy Wilder. In Double Indemnity, he plays a very dark character, goes against Fred McMurray's persona. And in this movie, he was a late addition because the original actor that was going to play that part died suddenly. And Billy Wilder called him and said, I have this part. Would you come and do it? And Fred McMurray said, yeah, sure, I'll be there. And again, this is a character that goes against Fred McMurray's image. There's something he saw some darkness in Fred McMurray, and Fred McMurray really brought that stuff out when he acted with him, which was great. These are two different portrayals, but they're also the things that make movie history, because after this movie came out, Fred McMurray was walking down the street and two women walked up to him and said that he ruined his image, and one of them hit him with his purse and walked away. And he thought that was a good sign that he actually played the part very well because somebody hated him for it. That could also be one of those famous movie Hollywood stories.
Those myths.
So you had Jack Lemmon, who Billy Wilder really loved working with. He would go on to work with him six more times. And then you had Shirley MacLaine, who really fit his pixie-ish quality that he wanted for the role. And then you had Fred McMurray came in and really played that senior manager that was Baxter's foil throughout the movie. In fact, Baxter's foil that he didn't even know he had.
I thought it was very interesting that the word that Billy Wilder used for Shirley MacLaine's character was pixie-ish, because pixie is a word that we see often when it comes to romantic comedies, with the rise of the manic pixie dream girl that is very popular today. And in a sense that you could kind of call Shirley MacLaine's character a manic pixie dream girl, because she's billed as this end-all be-all, but she, unlike many women in romantic comedies today, she has a lot more depth to her, and she has a lot more substance, even though she is also a woman character written by a man to be a love interest. She has this kind of sparky behavior around her that allows her to be a little bit more independent. I love the way that this movie looked, and one of the reasons why it's so aesthetically pleasing and the shots are done really well is because it's in widescreen.
So there's two things that I want to follow up on that with. One of them is that, yes, it's widescreen, but it's, more importantly, it's anamorphic, which means that they have a special lens on the camera, as you know, that records the image on regular 35mm film, but it's kind of squeezed in, so it's taller and thinner. So when it's projected back out, there's a special lens on the projector that spreads the image out again, so it is widescreen. The whole point of anamorphic is that you can use regular film to shoot it and get a really beautiful widescreen shot.
But one of the problems is if you're shooting in color...
Yeah, you have to flood it with light.
You have to flood it with light because of the fact that the color gets muddled and it starts to like blur and
the film isn't as fast. Yeah, the film isn't as fast, doesn't record as much light. So what happens is they either get really flat lighting, or they have to open up the aperture so much that your depth of field is so small that you have to shoot a lot of close-ups. Actors can't be as active because they'll walk out of the focus really quickly. So it becomes a different headache. But when you shoot anamorphic black and white, like a few of these films did at this time, all those problems go away. You can have as deep a depth of field as you want. You can be as crisp and clean as you want. It really adds the special effects too, because like the office room is all done with forced perspective. Like the desks in the front are big desks with adults. And as you get farther back, there are smaller desks with smaller people, all the way to the very, very back where there's desks with kids in them. So it looks to us like this is big, huge, long room, but you can really do that forced perspective effect really well in camera, because when you're shooting it black and white, you don't see the issues. It looks real. So that's one of the things that they were able to do. They were able to also stage things close to the camera on one side, on the right side of the camera, the frame, and they have something happening far in the background on the left side or vice versa, and they're both in focus. So you could both see, the audience could see that the foreground action may not have matching the background action, which of course is building some tension or drama, or in some cases, some comedy too. And so it really freed them up. For me, a really beautiful film to look at because they're used the camera space in their frame very well throughout the entire film.
So you mentioned before that in 1945, he had a nugget of an idea for this movie, and he said that the audience at that time would not have been prepared for that. But while also reading for this movie, I found out that the film was released and received a lot of mixed messages, and even some critics didn't like the subject matter of adultery. It was called A Dirty Fairy Tale.
There were multiple critics. Pauline Kael didn't particularly like it. A couple other critics who the names escape me right now. There was one critic who said, yeah, it's a dirty fairy tale. They didn't like the way that it was talking about how these two people fell in love in the middle of a story that was basically centered around these men at this firm being adulterers, even though there was mixed reviews. There were a lot of critics who did actually step up and like the film. And the movie was a hit. I think what he was trying to say is in 1945, he knew that if he made that movie, there was only one way he could have made it, which is the fact that everybody who was an adulterer had to be punished by the end, according to the Hays Code. And then it probably wasn't going to be a comedy. And he liked to put in comedy in the dramatic scenes and then put a little bit of dash of drama in the comedic scenes so it felt more like real life. Yeah, it's a comedy in the sense, sometimes in the Shakespearean sense, that it may not all be laugh-laugh, but nobody dies, so everybody lives to the end.
I mean, it is a Shakespearean comedy in the sense that it follows most of the romance rules, in the sense of it doesn't end in a marriage, but it ends in two people getting together.
Yeah. I think the thing for me is that even with all the mixed reviews, the audiences liked it. And in the end, it received a host of award nominations, winning 5 Oscars, including Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Screenplay. Those are all awards that Billy Wilder and I.L. Diamond were nominated for the year before for Some Like It Hot and didn't win. So some people kind of feel that they got these awards in 1960 because of Some Like It Hot. I feel it's because when you make two movies back to back like that, yeah, you deserve recognition. Not only are you showing people that you can write and direct really good movies, they're two different movies and they have two different outcomes and they're filmed two different ways and they're both amazing. I find it, for me, very interesting that even though he waited 15 years, some people still didn't like it. But he also was pushing, through the 50s, a lot of his movies were pushing Hollywood's boundaries. I think he became more comfortable as a filmmaker, and so he felt like pushing the boundaries was more open to him. And the previous years, Some Like It Hot definitely had some subject matter that some people didn't like because it touched on homosexuality and cross-dressing, and there were a lot of people that didn't like that either.
So you mentioned that in earlier that this movie is the peak of Wilder's directing and screenwriting career. Well, this movie is a wonderful and amazing movie. Most people recognize Some Like It Hot more than The Apartment. So why do you think The Apartment is the epitome of his career?
Well, there's a couple different reasons. One, it was his favorite film. Two, you look at that previous decade. So from 1950 to 1960, he directed these films. Sunset Boulevard in 1950, Ace in the Hole in 1951, Stalag 17 in 1953, Sabrina 1954, 7-Year Itch, his first movie with Marilyn Monroe in 1955, Spirit of St. Louis 1957, Love in the Afternoon 1957, Witness for the Prosecution, 1957, Some Like It Hot, 1959, and The Apartment in 1960. So you look at those movies back to back and you go, there are four of his best movies in that 10-year period. The other ones are still really good movies. And even the one that's considered his bomb, his flop, Ace in the Hole, has been reexamined recently. And because I think the reason it didn't do so well in 1951 is it's a very cynical look at the way that a newsman uses the media to get what he wants out of a situation. He had Stalag 17, which is a war movie. He had two romantic comedies, Sabrina and 7 Year Itch.
I love Sabrina because I love the outfits.
All right. Then he did a pretty straightforward biopic, Spirit of St. Louis, about Lindbergh's flight across the Atlantic. It was really well made. And then he had Love in the Afternoon, which is another romantic drama. Then he decided, you know what? Hitchcock makes all these thriller mysteries, so I'm going to go make one, Witness for the Prosecution, which is an amazing film. If anybody has a chance to see it, watch it, and don't tell anybody the twist ending. After he made Witness for the Prosecution, he just took the hard left and goes, I'm going to make a comedy, Some Like It Hot, make it one of the best ones ever anybody's ever considered, and then make The Apartment. And that's just 10 years before The Apartment. I feel like that this whole thing is his pinnacle. After this, he has a couple good movies, but pretty much by the end of the 60s, he's only making one movie every 2-3 years. And by the end, his last two movies are in 78 and 81 are pretty uneven.
How did those films influence The Apartment?
Well, I feel like The Apartment was a blend of the light comedy of 7 Year Itch and Some Like It Hot, mixed with the darker drama elements of Sunset Boulevard and Ace in the Hole, and a very nice blending of comedy, drama, and romance. So one wasn't outweighing or overshadowing the other. He attempted this earlier in Stalag 17. It's a war movie about POWs in a German POW camp. And there is some comedy in there. There's two POWs who are considered the comic relief, and they're a little ham-fisted with their comedy. Later on, it evens out a little bit. Although Stalag 17 is one of my favorite movies he did, I feel like he got the blending right on this one, where there wasn't a performance that popped out or a comedy thing that popped out and outweighed a drama or vice versa. So that's why I feel like that previous 10 years, he comes in at The Apartment and hits it.
I am currently writing a screenplay. One of the things that people have told me, or you even have told me, is that you should study The Apartment for structure, beats, and especially how to play off the third act by laying the groundwork in the first act, because a lot of people in movies that are being made today, multi-million dollar movies, there's no payout because things aren't getting set up, and it just kind of feels like it's going out of nowhere. Moxie is one of those movies that we have discussed as a family, saying that we didn't think the third act payout was earned. And one of the things is, in this movie, it's such a wonderful example of laying all your groundwork and all the amazing, wonderful screenplay stuff.
Yeah, it has a lot of great, wonderful screenplay stuff. He's a good writer, even though he's always written with a partner. One of his first partner was Charles Brackett. They wrote Ninotchka, which was one of the best comedies, romantic comedies, in the 30s with Greta Garbo. Then when he moved on and Charles Brackett and him kind of broke up, he started writing with I.A.L. Diamond. So he's the one that really works on structure. He's all about structure because he came from Germany and English wasn't his first language. His partners tended to be the ones that worked on dialogue. He worked on rhythms. He liked rhythm in his dialogue, so he really worked with him on that. And Charles Brackett openly said this in his diary, that was his main focus, was working on dialogue. And it also came that was the way his relationship was with I.A.L. Diamond, too. One of the reasons he became a director, people tend to forget this, is because he would work with his writing partners. They'd write these great screenplays. They'd have these jokes that would be in the beginning, and then they'd be paid off, and then there'd be like a reference to them in the middle, and then there'd be a second joke towards the end that had an even bigger payoff. The director or the actor didn't understand the joke. They would cut it, and then later on they'd do the second joke And nobody would think it was funny because there was no first joke that set it up, and the reference in the middle was cut or didn't make sense either. So he said they kept on screwing up my screenplay, so I just went in there and said I should direct. He did direct one movie in France before he came to America when he was leaving Germany. He left Germany because of the rise of Hitler, went to told all his stuff, went to France, worked there, saw that that wasn't far enough, and then came to America and started working in the American film industry. So, Izzy, how did you like this movie?
I thought this movie was a really good movie. I thought it was a really great movie. It was structured very well, which goes to show that structure is very important. The dialogue is snappy and hilarious. It was acted wonderfully by all three main actors and even the supporting actors. One of my favorite characters is this Snoopy secretary, you know. And also, when you have a character who is the designated bad guy, and he's not cartoonishly bad, but he still gets underneath your skin, it's a wonderfully acted and written villain, and he totally brings in the whole movie together, and I really enjoyed this movie.
I was really happy that when I went back and watched it, that I found new parts of it that I had either not remembered or were new to me, and I thought were really good. The cinematography still wowed me. The story structure really wowed me. I love the payoffs that he lays in the beginning, even more serious scenes that have major consequences, like when he quits working at the insurance company and he gives the key to the executive washroom to Fred McMurray. This was set up back in Act One that his apartment key is very similar to the executive washroom key by a mistake that somebody else who was borrowing the apartment had done. So we've already set this up earlier in the film. And so when he throws the key at Fred McMurray to land on his desk, and Fred McMurray thinks he has won over C.C. Baxter, and he grabs the key, and then C.C. Baxter walks away, we all think that he gave him the key to the apartment. Everybody. Fred McMurray, the audience, everybody. And then we walk into the next room. Fred McMurray follows him and goes, "Hey, you gave me the wrong key. You gave me the executive bathroom key." That whole thing is all already set up. And that's the thing I love about this movie, that no shot, no business, like funny business at the beginning that seems to be like, this is a funny joke that he has the wrong key, ha ha. Later on, it matters. And I think that when I watch this again, all those little pieces just amaze me that they're all in that movie.
Even with the mirror scene where C.C. Baxter realizes that Mr. Sheldrake's extramarital affair is with Shirley MacLaine's character, and he finds that out because of the fact that he knows that this mirror that Shirley MacLaine has given him to look at his hat to see how gorgeous he looks in this amazing hat, he realizes that the mistress is Shirley MacLaine, and that payoff is so wonderful because she's in the room with him and he can't say anything, he won't say anything, it's just hangs in the air, and it's such a wonderful scene.
Yes, those are the reasons why when you're writing your screenplay and you're asking questions, I said you should really watch this movie for structure, because I remember there being payoffs. I didn't remember how amazing the job was that he did on structuring this. And I think that's the thing that, as a young screenwriter, going back and using these as learning tools is really, really cool, because you're going to interpret those plot points differently. Your payoffs are going to be completely different in your screenplay. But just being able to watch somebody do it and see how it's done will allow you to, when you write your screenplay, this is how it is. This is my version of this payoff.
So do you think this movie holds up being made in 1960?
Yeah, I think for the most part it does. And I think the main reason is because none of the realism for me is that unfortunately, a lot of the people that do the wrong don't have this punishment. I mean, Sheldrake does end up having a divorce because his secretary, who he had had an affair with previous, calls up his wife and lets her know that he is having an affair with Shirley MacLaine's character. That's the only thing that his character has to deal with. He's still running the company. He's still in power. And for a certain period of time, he's still having a relationship with Shirley MacLaine. It wasn't until the very end when she realizes that C.C. Baxter really does love her and she goes back to be with him. And I find that, unfortunately, more realistic than a lot of films where at the end, the super bad, the villain somehow loses everything or gets publicly denounced or things like that. I find it, unfortunately, that's a lot more accurate in the 1960s world, all the way up until pretty much recently.
I do think that it holds up. I think it would fit right in the middle of the pantheon of romantic dramedies. The thing is, there's a lot of things that are cliche now that probably weren't cliche back then, that when you see it in movies now, you just roll your eyes and you're like, oh, it's another one. There is some misogyny and there is definitely social status and social doctrines that happen throughout this whole movie that we wouldn't do now. You know, like all the women are secretaries and all the men are employees and things like that. So there's definitely some things that date this movie, but I thought it was actually a pretty good romantic dramedy in the sense that it talks about consequences. Everything has its own payout. Everything is earned. So things that are cliche now don't feel so dumb and cliche and misogynistic. I really enjoyed this movie. I probably watch it again. Don't tell Dad that he picked a good movie.
Yeah. So another thing that I think that holds up, why this film holds up, is that its central character, Baxter, played by Jack Lemmon, isn't your standard leading man from that time period. He doesn't like violence. You know this from the beginning because when he's going to eat his dinner and all there is violent Westerns on TV, he keeps changing the channel until he finds a movie on another channel. That's The Grand Hotel, which is a very famous romantic movie from the 30s. He can't wait to watch it. He treats everybody differently. He's the only character that treats the women in the film with respect. Even though it's ironic because everybody thinks he's a womanizer, so everybody thinks he's not treating women with respect in their point of view, but he actually is the one character that's treating the women with respect and is worried about their well-being. And he realizes that he's complicit in these men's treatment of their mistresses, and that's why he chooses to walk away. The scene that Izzy talked about earlier, where he borrows Fran's mirror and realizes this, it was the mirror that was left at his apartment earlier in the movie, hence why he knows that Fran is Mr. Sheldrake's mistress. He is about to tell... This is the highest high that he's had. He's going to be promoted again. He has a new hat. He's super excited. He's talking to her about all the great things that have happened. And he's about to start, you know, he's going to ask her to go out on a date or something like that. And he then sees the mirror. He can't tell her that he knows. And it deflates the highest high and becomes one of his lowest lows. And that's another thing that Billy Wilder does really well, is there's definitely a roller coaster. There's always, whenever there's a scene that is a character with its highest high, there will eventually be a beat that takes that character to a low or an unintended consequence that will change the direction of the movie. And so when he realizes that, it changes his direction. He starts to realize that he is complicit in what's happening in his apartment. And his whole demeanor changes with the other bosses and with Sheldrake for the rest of the movie. So I think that's another reason why it holds up, is because the character realizes his complicity. He doesn't try to explain it away. He realizes it and decides to move on.
I also think one of the reasons why this movie holds up is that this movie focuses on the characters. It focuses on the people. It is billed as a romance film, but they focus on the people and how they can get to this ending of them being together instead of focusing on the plot and just fitting in characters whenever they need something, which is why we get a lot of stereotypes like the manic pixie dream girl in romantic comedies, because it's just easy to put cardboard cutouts of something so that you can get the end result faster. But this movie takes its time, builds each single character, gives them their wants, their needs, their complicated wants and needs, and doesn't pull any punches.
So, who would you recommend this movie to?
To be honest, the people that I would recommend this movie to is everyone, because I think there's a little bit of everything for everyone. You know, there's the comedy for the comedy people, there's drama for the dramedy people, there's romance for the romance people, there's old ladies telling young men off, there's everything for everybody. It also has a really cool retro feel, which seems very modern when you watch the movie. Most of the people that I would recommend it to probably has already seen it. And like my dad has said, if you haven't gone to seen it yet, I would recommend doing so.
Yeah, I would recommend this film, like you said, to a broad audience. And, you know, people who like smart, sophisticated romantic comedies, people who may not know Billy Wilder's work. It's kind of sad that he's not listed with the great directors of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. A lot of, you know, John Ford, Alfred Hitchcock, William Wyler. A lot of people put other directors in those, like, the great directors of this era. And he's oftentimes, like, kind of left off the list. He's thought of more of a screenwriter instead of a director. But when you think about the four movies he's directed, his big four, Double Indemnity, Sunset Boulevard, Some Like It Hot, and The Apartment, are all on top 100 lists from various groups in various publications that he should be up there as a great director. So I think if you really want to watch his work, I would definitely watch these, at least those four movies, but definitely people should go check out Billy Wilder's work, especially that decade, the 1950 through 1960. Like I said, but just for the prosecution, Stalag 17, movies that aren't considered the pinnacle of his career are still amazing films, are way better than a lot of people's best at that period. So Izzy, when we were watching this movie, I noticed that when a certain scene came up, you had at first a negative reaction to it. And then after the movie was done, you told me that you actively changed your mindset as the scene was playing out.
What I wanted to say about the suicide attempt was that when first watching it, I rolled my eyes at you and I was like, ugh, great. Another woman who's heartbroken, who has to dramatically attempt to suicide, which sadly happens a lot more than not in romantic dramedies. And the thing that kind of sucks about them is that they never seem like an end result. They never seem like they're earned. Not saying that you have to earn a suicide attempt, but they always feel like they come out of left field and tacked on for the story, and that they are never, that it's kind of a misogynistic idea of a woman who needs this man so much, is so destroyed that he has left her, that I cannot live without him. My life must end. And then usually is stopped by the man, and the man's like, don't do it for me. You know, the man who's the main person she's supposed to fall in love with. And then she's like, oh, I'm so sorry. It's a little dramatic, and frankly, kind of adds to this whole idea that women are emotional and that's all they are. But with Shirley MacLaine's character, the reason why she attempts suicide is because her boyfriend at the time is married, and kind of pseudo breaks up with her. It's not an overdramatic attempt. You know, it's actually done off screen. It's not shown, and it doesn't prove that Shirley MacLaine is just mentally ill and she's crazy and she's just an emotional woman. It's actually done as Shirley MacLaine's character can't see anything past the torment that she is getting from Mr. Sheldrake. The fact that he's using her, and he's pretty much putting his fantasies upon her. A lot of the men who are in romantic comedies kind of do that to women, that they put their own fantasies on her. And actually, Ruby Sparks is a really great movie about a manic pixie dream girl written by a man come to life, and I definitely recommend that movie. And they're like shown to, you know, just go with the flow, do what the man thinks is the epitome of a dream girl and this out there special woman. And one of the things that I like about this movie is that she's never downgraded. She is her own person with multiple feelings, with multiple attitudes, with multiple beliefs, with a backstory of her own, with a life outside of this main triangle. And I just thought that that was pretty cool.
I think the thing that balances this scene out is at the office party before the scene that between Mr. Sheldrake and Fran, is that you see Mr. Sheldrake's secretary, who used to be in Fran's shoes, having the affair with Mr. Sheldrake, confront her, tell her that she's the new one, and she lists four other women in the office who were previous and had these affairs with Mr. Sheldrake. Then she goes with Mr. Sheldrake to this apartment, and he doesn't have time to really spend any time with her. There's presents sitting on her chair. She gives him a present, which is this record of a performer who performs at this restaurant that they go to. So it's a very romantic gesture. And he kind of just throws it and goes, oh, that's cute, and throws it down.
You have to keep it here. I don't want my wife to see.
You know? Yeah, you have to keep it here. I don't want my wife to see it. He kind of just throws it down. And then he picks up the present, puts it on his coat, and picks up the presents and says, I have to go back to my family. And you realize that the presents that he brought are not for her. And then he reaches in and grabs his wallet, peels off a $100 bill, and hands it to her. And he goes, I didn't get you anything. Why don't you get something? You know, it's awkward for me to shop for you. And at that point, she starts to take off her coat. He goes, no, I got to go. And she makes the comment like, well, since it's paid for, don't you want it? At that point, tells you exactly what her mindset is. And then he leaves and she starts to cry. And then she goes to wash her face in the sink. And that's when she sees the sleeping pills, and one thing leads to another. When Jack Lemmon comes back to his apartment, we know she is in the other room. We know the last thing that she had was the sleeping pills. We don't know what the status is. And there's a lot of tension being built up. And then he finally discovers her, and he ends up saving her life because his next door neighbor is a doctor, and he goes and gets the doctor to help her. And he starts to take care of her. And the second thing that bounces out is that he talks about the fact that he was in love with his best friend's wife and he tried to attempt suicide. And his story is, it's really quick and it's very emotional. And he's like, basically tells her that, yeah, I ended up accidentally shooting myself and in the knee because of this comedic series of events. And she goes, well, did it heal? And he goes, well, girl, I was over her in 3 weeks, but it took me a year to heal my leg. So there's this thing where there's a balance in this movie where it's not, as you said, just showing that women are emotional, that there are men that are emotional too, that this happens all over the place. There's more stories about this than you would think. And that's one of their bonding points. And I think that's one of the things that I really enjoy about the film is that there's the characters are layered and there's a history that you can tell that each character has a history. She mentions her history. Like you said, she has a life outside of this triangle. He has a life outside of this triangle. You even see Sheldrake's life out of this triangle. And then that scene really does confirm with you that he is a snake. But at the same time, you understand these are three-dimensional characters versus
cardboard cutouts that are just supposed to represent an ideal of a person.
Yeah, it's what I call paint by numbers. We all know that we need this, like you said, you're fitting characters into the plot versus having the characters move through the story and influence the story. It's a good balance of plot character. You need some plot, you need some character, and there's a good balance in there, which is another reason why it's a good screenplay to really look at and study.
Thank you for listening to our podcast this week. We will be posting a new show every Tuesday. And if you enjoyed this episode, be a mensch and please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review. And follow us on Instagram at TML, A Journey Through Cinema, and Twitter at TML, A Journey. We also have a Facebook page under The Movie Log. We hope to hear from you.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.